Take a network break. Enjoy a springtime virtual donut sprinkled with pollen and join us for our weekly sprint through interesting networking and tech news. On today's show, we discuss a new Cisco security product, Broadcom's continued efforts to soothe unsettled VMware customers, the latest counter move in the ongoing tech infrastructure battles between the US and China, and more. We're sponsored today by Palo Alto Networks. Your branch has changed, your SD-WAN should too. Palo Alto Networks wants to show you how AI and ML are powering next-gen SD-WAN and SASE for the branch. SDX Central and Palo Alto Networks hosted an exclusive online event that shows how next-gen SD-WAN and SASE can help you modernize and secure your branches. Go to sdxcentral.com to get the link to this free event to see the replay, or find that link in the show notes for Network Break episode 475. We are also sponsored by Palo Alto Networks for today's Tech Bytes. When designing your SD-WAN and SSE strategy, you have the option to mix and match these products and services. Sponsor Palo Alto Networks is here to offer a counter-argument. When it comes to SASE, a single-vendor approach may have benefits that beat the mix and match options, and we discuss. Last but not least, if you're not aware, we've got a bunch of new shows in the Packet Pushers Network. That includes Packet Protector. This is a security podcast I'm co-hosting with Jennifer Manella, and Network Automation Nerds. It's about automation and more with automation and Python expert Eric Chow. You can find it all at packetpushers.net. To the news, Cisco has announced a new security offering it's calling Hypershield. It's a distributed security offering. It aims to put monitoring and enforcement closer to workloads via software agents. One option is to run what Cisco calls the Tesseract security agent. Tesseract uses eBPF to run at the kernel level of a server OS so it can inspect processes and provide enforcement. Cisco recently acquired an eBPF startup called Isovalent, which Cisco is leveraging for this. The eBPF agent will have visibility into packets, to file and system calls, and kernel functions. It'll monitor all that data for anomalies. Behavior and alert or block based on policies. They'll also have an option to run this agent in a VM or container.
Yeah, so just to come back to Isovalent, Isovalent was a respin of a company called PlumGrid.
Oh, was it really?
Years ago. Yeah. And they had this, the people that were working in PlumGrid kind of came up with this idea that if I could run code in the kernel in the networking stack, then I could put applications, sort of pseudo applications, and not require access to the kernel.
Yeah.
And somebody decided that this was a really good idea and started to write code. And turns out that this person was like an uber mensch Linux kernel person.
you would have to be.
And was able to get the eBPF code streamlined into the kernel over the period of 2 or 3 years. And that was part of what PlumGrid was doing. And they were trying to productize that particular approach. And then that was then further advanced by Isovalent. So to some extent, Isovalent is a key player in the eBPF algorithm. Now, the key here, I think, for Cisco, and now we're sort of seeing why they acquired Isovalent and why it's so significant and why I continue to maintain it, is that eBPF is kind of like you can put rules or sort of like programs. They're not Python, they're not runtimes, but you can put eBPF runtimes in a sort of a secure, jailed, you know,
in a sandbox environment. Yeah, sandbox environment inside the kernel.
Yeah, sandbox, safe environment. And you can see all the data that's going in and out. It's actually used for a lot of other things. It's now actually used for telemetry, kernel telemetry, and so forth and so on. But in a
networking
context.
Yes, being widely used in Kubernetes as well, yeah.
That's right. So instead of having a sidecar proxy, we now put the agent into an eBPF. So the key thing about eBPF is that over time, it's been accelerated via DPDK, you know, the networking hardware network acceleration functions that Intel put together for around its x86 CPUs. We're also now seeing SmartNIC providers can accelerate eBPF functions, so you don't have to do them in the operating system per se. Or if you're doing them in the operating system, you can transparently accelerate them by they just get handed off to the SmartNIC or redirected to the SmartNIC. And in the case of DPUs, you can now just load eBPF programs directly to the DPU. So you could install conceptually something like a firewall or an IDS or a content inspection engine or a telemetry system, you know, into a DPU and have zero impact onto your hosts. Mm-hmm. Now, I think this is really interesting. Now, first of all, I do want to just point out this announcement's very light on details, Drew. When you actually go and look for documentation, there isn't any. So it's one of those classic launches that Cisco is the only vendor left doing in 2024. That is, we announce it, but we don't put anything out there about it. So the first wave is only the information that they strictly want you to see. So everything here comes with a caveat in that the source material is fairly limited. And so you go looking for documentation or something. It says, oh, no, we're going to have a big launch next week. The webinars are next week and everybody can come and listen. That's a week away, right? Mm-hmm. And the product's not coming for 6 months away. So it's something that Cisco's done for a long time. It goes out there and talks about it. It's sort of one way to look at it is they release the product before it's finished, but it's sort of finished, but they don't know which features to work on or to focus on. So they announce it and then go out to customers and sort of seed the idea that they should be ready to buy this product and get it onto the strategy. And I think that's what it's my view that Cisco's doing there here. So if you're a Cisco, you know, customer, I'm pretty sure that Cisco sales reps are out there knocking on your doors with a sneak peek under NDA for selected customers, which is what we saw. That's a fairly standard Cisco approach, and they believe that that's a strong way to come to market. So they describe it as a cloud-native, AI-powered approach to highly distributed security for AI-scale data centers that's built into the fabric of the network. So what I see this saying is they're saying that there's nodes all over a network. There's SD-WAN edge. There's the devices themselves. If you could put an agent out on those devices, you talked about the Tesseract agent. Uh-huh. So eBPF is in iPhones, for example, and Android. So if you can get an agent that can access eBPF on those devices, now all of a sudden you've got a viable way to produce and support security agents or you know, cybersecurity elements without having to actually write a client for each platform, which is a big deal.
Yep.
Because if you have to write a code for iOS 18, iOS 17, iOS 16, because your enterprises are always, you know, whatever, that's an awful lot of effort and an awful lot of cost. But if you can just use something that's built into the operating system, then this puts Cisco a jump ahead of many of its competitors by moving to a much more modernized. However, it's also unproven, right? So this is where the iSurveillance acquisition might come in and where we think. But also key, as you pointed out, Drew, is that eBPF is in containers, but also it can get into VMs because you can put it into the operating system. So if you're running Linux inside a VM, you can use the eBPF inside of the Linux, or you can put it into a SmartNIC or a DPU and have the agent there. So that then starts to become a competitor to NSX.
Right.
And SD-WAN or SSE, more correctly, or Zero Trust. Because now if you can move those agents right out into the device, but also have the agent in routers and in the data center and on the campus as well. So we'll come to this in a minute, but in the campus, then all of a sudden Cisco's got a whole networking security strategy that they never had before, a joined up single thing. Am I wrong? Did you see that?
No, I definitely think right now this is very much future oriented. I think the agent is supposed to be available starting in August. They also talked about being able to run this on DPUs, but that's something for the future. They also talked about Cisco's going to roll out smart switches, which are Cisco switches with a DPU, and you can run this agent on that DPU on the switch. That is also on the future roadmap. So I think Cisco does have grand plans for this. It's funny you mentioned NSX, because as I was trying to figure out what this was, I was like, this sounds exactly like what NSX has been talking about with distributed firewalls running in VMs throughout your data center for years, and talked about by Tom Gillis, formerly of VMware, now at Cisco. So Cisco's like, this is new. This has never been done before. And I'm like, no, it's been done quite a lot with NSX. Beware the hype.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's definitely an element of that in the sense that VMware has VeloCloud, NSX, and as part of Broadcom, it also has Symantec. Before, it might have used Carbon Black, but they've sold Carbon Black. But Symantec has endpoint protection, right? Uh-huh. So VMware does have something that can stitch that networking together, but they've got much less credibility in terms of as a WAN provider or a campus provider, right? So they can get inside of devices, perhaps, but can they get, you know, can they compete with something like Cisco, who's going to install an agent that's going to tap IFT into a non-specific, you know, using eBPF? It doesn't actually have to tap in as an app that they have to write and support.
I will agree with Cisco that what's the difference here is the eBPF element, the ability to run sort of a lightweight application in the kernel, which gives you, I think, much greater visibility than you would get in user space. I do think that is a unique element to this, aside from all of the other stuff they threw at it about AI and blah, blah, blah. That is, I think, the compelling differentiator.
It is. And however, but with the AI, they're actually making a pitch, which I'm having a little bit of a problem with. They're saying the AI part comes with a dynamic response. So what they quote in the press release is compensation controls can be set running wherever they're needed on the network, reconfiguring it on the fly against a live attack. So what they're suggesting here is that they've got an AI part to this strategy, and it could see something happening in the network, and the AI will then go and put compensating controls in place to response to a live attack. I'm going to have a bit of a problem with that. I don't think AI is ready for that. And I suspect that Cisco is saying that this is like manifesting. I'm manifesting my future by saying it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
You know, Yeah. You know, it's all the thing amongst the kids today, you know, to say, I'm going to manifest my future. I want, you know, blah, blah, blah.
You need to say it to give it any chance of ever coming true is the idea. Yes.
Yeah. That doesn't mean it'll come true, but no. At least if you're manifesting, but you can say, oh, I meant this all along. Yeah. I meant this all along, you know? So I personally think that, you know, believing that any vendor is in a good position to, use AI to, dynamically reconfigure the network to harden it against a live attack is still some ways off. I would say that's an aspirational comment. Because, if they were going to do that, if they had that capability, they'd be doing it in ACI or in Meraki, right? Mm-hmm. And they're just not. So, but on the other hand, this is the first time I've seen AI in a Cisco product. And Cisco does have a number of AI initiatives internally, I believe, but this is the first one I think to see light of day from Cisco. Whereas its competitors, if you look at Palo or Fortinet, they are all using AI in modest ways, mostly in their cybersecurity detection and so forth. They made a big deal. Whereas Cisco doesn't seem to suggest that it's using AI to detect security events inside of a system. Well, it may well be. It just means I haven't seen it. So, they go on to say Cisco Hypershield literally turns the security network model upside down, bringing the power of hyperscaler security and connectivity to the enterprise. I think that's a recognition that current security tools are just too complex to use. And Cisco is probably one of the worst offenders here. They've got this business unit over here doing this and this business over here, and then the SD-WANs over here and the SSEs over here, and then Duo's doing the AAA and the Zero Trust is over here. And if you want to do the campus, you have to go and get Lisp and, put an overlay network in there and start to use SGTs and, security group tags and all that sort of stuff. And I think Cisco's realized that customers are pushing back against that and going, I don't want that. I don't want to have a campus security solution. I need something that's the whole network. So the way I sort of start to see this is saying that Cisco is building something that supports the whole thing. And I don't think we can underestimate the importance of smart switches here, Drew. Cisco can go back to all of its customers and say, all those switches that you bought 3 years ago to support need to upgrade them to these ones that have got DPUs on board so that you can run our Hypershield security architecture.
Yes.
And sort of force a sales cycle around that. And we know that works really, really classic. Well, F5 and Cisco. Yeah, classic. Yeah. So Cisco's going to love selling that hardware. Upgrading the install base is going to be good for shareholders. I imagine customers who recently upgraded their campus won't be too pleased, but, that's the way the world works. And I also think that, you can probably live with your existing strategy for another 5 to 10 years before your subscription gets end of life. So once Hypershield, winds up and gets a critical mass, Cisco will EOL the legacy one and drive you into an upgrade cycle at their convenience. So subscription licensing is absolutely perfect for that. Two ways to look at that. You get to see your network stay up to date because Cisco's forcing you to upgrade on a consistent basis. So you're always on a modern platform that's proven, or the other way is you're being forced to upgrade and forced to spend money that you didn't want to. So two ways of looking at that. I think overall Cisco's behind the eight ball here. Everybody else has gotten out in the security market with an AI strategy, but this is absolutely what Cisco needs to do. Take a whole network approach. It's like one-upping all the competition. Does that make sense? Do you see that?
I do see that, because they can put this agent essentially anywhere you're running some form of compute, that this agent could sit, and they say so now they've got essentially what they could call a security fabric across their entire portfolio and third party portfolios, if it can run in a server on a DPU or in a VM in a server that Cisco doesn't own. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but you could also see, access routers with a DPU on board running this code so it can run a firewall.
Yeah, yeah. I think they're aiming this at the data center, but you could easily see it extending out to campus, to WAN, to the branch, et cetera. No problem. Yeah.
Well, I think the data center is important because Cisco's being displaced from the data center by the VMware VCF. The thing about VMware Cloud Foundation, we'll talk more about this in a minute, about Broadcom's happenings this week, but you figure that customers are now being forced to buy, or having no choice, but they're getting NSX licenses. Well, that means you've got no reason not to deploy them. And all of a sudden, the physical underlay of the network, if you've got ACI today to do something, then that becomes much less important. And in fact, probably less and less used as NSX gets more and more used. And so if Cisco doesn't come in with something in this space that can, stop NSX from paving over the network in the data center, then Cisco could be, to some extent, or progressively displaced from the data center over time as a networking provider, because most customers I know who are using NSX and who I've spoken to just put a bunch of white box in with some basic routing you know, IP routing. They don't need to do anything in the network. Just all gets done inside of the NSX, and the VMs move around and all that. So different type of approach.
Yeah. Yeah, well, NSX brings its own complexity, so it's not an instant. Since we have it, I guess we'll just turn it on and use it. It's much more of a lift than that, but I see your point. I like the theory behind distributed security controls, distributed agents to do monitoring and enforcement. I like the idea back when we were talking about host IPS. I like the idea when VMware was talking about it in NSX. I like the idea that Cisco's talking about it, and eBPF should get you more granular visibility into system calls and things that are going on. The difficulty is on the execution. How good is the backend system at doing analytics on all this data to actually identify legitimate threats and provide the necessary context around that threat for you to actually do something about it? If Cisco hasn't solved that, they've just added another noise machine to all the other noise machines that are firing alerts and sounding alarms. So theory sounds good. We got to see how they execute, as always.
Yeah, I think, you know, Cisco's history of executing cleanly on a strategy this comprehensive and with this many moving parts would make me pause. And I would certainly be looking at it and considering it, but I would wait to see some deliverables before I would get too hot and bothered about it, because this is very shallow. There's not much here to look at. It's just basically a bunch of blog posts from executives who are, you know, as I said, manifesting their future. I'm sure there's something in behind here, and you know, the acquisition of iSurveillance is obviously important.
Yeah.
Cisco has all the building blocks, but then Cisco historically has not been good at bringing them together into something that's unified. They've been much better at keeping lots of little silos of these things and then selling them. So this displaces a lot of its current revenue, right? So if you're buying Umbrella today and, you know, Viptela SD-WAN and doing SSE and using, you know, all of that changes in this environment. So I wouldn't rush into this, but it's exciting to see that Cisco's got something coming to displace the threats that are obviously appearing in its market.
Yeah, and frankly, I'm impressed with how quickly Cisco has managed to leverage this iSurveillance acquisition, because it just closed fairly recently, and they're already rolling out a strategy to incorporate iSurveillance into the portfolio.
Well, eBPF is open source, so they've probably been developing it for years and decided that, you know what, we need more eBPF-ness. Need more control over that open source project, more developers who can do eBPF to help us get this, you know, accelerate this product development. That would be my thinking on that.
Yeah. All right. Links in the show notes if you want to try to wade your way through the announcements. We'll move on. Broadcom CEO Hock Tan wants to clarify Broadcom's strategy with VMware. Tan released a blog post to outline those clarifications. They've got several major points. First, the company wants to make private clouds competitive with public clouds. Tan has pledged to invest billions of dollars into R&D around VMware Cloud Foundation to make that happen. He also claims that the price of VMware Cloud Foundation, or VCF, has been radically reduced, half the list price compared to past pricing. I think we need to check on that. And third, he reaffirmed that the company will be moving entirely to a subscription-based model, although there are a few stops in there for customers who still want to stay on perpetual licenses.
Yeah, so obviously VMware customers continue to struggle with the product transitions after the Broadcom acquisition. And a blog post that nominally comes from Hock Tan, who is the CEO of Broadcom. I mean, let's face it, Drew, someone else wrote it, but it's tagged as CEO.
I'm sure it was written by a committee.
Take that for the signal it is.
Yes.
Yeah, probably lawyers as well. So, but let's pretend. Let's go with that.
Yes.
His first comment was, let's go through the three points. First, we remain steadfast in our decision to focus our resources on R&D and continuing to develop a true seamless private cloud experience for customers through VCF, one that is competitive with the public cloud. And I think there's a couple of things you can extrapolate to this. Like, first of all, when Broadcom first announced that it was acquiring VMware, we indicated that it was expecting to significantly increase the profit margins, and that one way that they could do that to maximize the profits from VMware was to cut investment in the product. I would suggest to you that enough customers have picked up on that message, and customers are seeking reassurance that VMware is not doing that. Does that make sense?
It totally
does.
So
the first thing is, yeah. I think also the second thing to say here is that customers haven't taken up VCF before the acquisition in very large numbers. And you might say that maybe VCF wasn't very good, or you might want to say it wasn't offering sufficient value, or maybe the pain of deploying VCF was too high. But I think Broadcom saying, look, you have to want to build an on-premise private cloud. You can't just start having hypervisors and then installing SANs and have some hand-configured SANs over here and then have a network over here where you're still configuring on the CLI. That's not cloud. That's where we were 10 years ago. That's not where you're going to be in the future. So we want to make sure that we're only picking where the future is going, and that means having a public cloud-like experience on-prem. And VMware has been trying to do that for a long time.
Yes.
But my point would be is that VCF and before it vCloud and whatever all the iterations were weren't good enough to convince customers to switch. Does that make sense?
It does, yep.
So assuring customers about those investment addresses potentially those objections. The second thing that he said is we're making changes to deliver consistent customer experiences. There's a couple of things in there that I think I could suggest. There are more, but let's go with a couple. Prior to Broadcom, the VMware path to market was absolutely a mess. Way too many SKUs, too many dealer programs. You know, you could buy a license for ESX this and ESX plus plus and VSV, and you know, just way too many products. And yeah. I imagine that internally at VMware, it was just a nightmare. But I'll give you an example. We talked 2 or 3 months ago about Dell having a 3% extra discount because it was a wholesaler and a reseller combined.
Uh-huh.
So instead of VMware selling to the distributor and then selling onto a reseller, Dell had a competitive advantage of 3% because, you know, Dell used to own VMware. And right. So that's all been wiped clean. Everybody's now on an equal footing and the whole dealer, you know, path to market's been wiped clean. Okay. Consistent customer experiences. For the resellers, it should mean, you know, you're not competing against somebody who's got a competitive advantage because they've been managed to squeeze a lucky deal with somebody that they knew or their brother-in-law was working at VMware or something. Do you know?
Right.
That's totally. The sort of thing that I had in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But also keep in mind that Broadcom's already taken the largest accounts to its own direct sales team, and that means the resellers have to adjust anyway.
Right.
So there's a fair bit of pain there. But I think the biggest pain here is off-prem cloud. Broadcom wants to be able to say to people, you've got an off-prem cloud. If you're going to build on VMware on AWS or VMware on Google or VMware on Azure, you have to have the same thing on-prem. And the only way that you can do that is if you've got VCF, right?
Right.
So they have to force push customers into VCF. They have to, if you like, give them every incentive, even if it's a negative incentive, like we're going to take away all the other products. And if you don't come, you don't come, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the flip side of this is that you are now in a position where you have one VMware product, whether you're running on-prem, off-prem. So you could much more likely to be able to migrate a VM and its data off AWS back on-prem if you're running the same software on-prem and off-prem.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. It's a good argument,
so
frankly.
Now when you start to... Yeah. Or if you want to run on a second tier cloud like Vulture or Equinix or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so that's the vision I think they're trying to push. And a lot of people aren't seeing that because they're out there with this, you know, an artisanal cloud, which is a bunch of ESX hypervisors with some handcrafted salt stack / Python Ansible, you know, NetBox, whatever out there. And that's not going to compete against AWS in the long run. And for what Broadcom thinks, or what I think Broadcom thinks, is they don't want to be in that market. They don't want to, they've bought VMware, they've got to look at this as a decade-long acquisition. They don't want to be investing in, you know, all of the stuff that used to, so VCF, that's just VCF. And so if you don't like that, you've got to make a decision whether to, and I think really what people have to face up is you either get on board or you get off.
Pretty much.
I think Broadcom's sort of doubling down here, right? We're making changes to deliver consistent customer experiences. Code for, we're going with a single thing, get on board or get out, is my decoding of it.
You can have any color you want as long as it's black, essentially.
Yeah, Henry Ford.
Yep.
And then the third part was VMware will complete the transition plan to a subscription model that provides access to the most recent version plus support for a fixed term. VMware began this transition and we're one of the last software companies to adopt this model. Okay, so subscription licensing is not popular. It requires significant changes to IT operations, particularly around budgeting, accounting, how you do your upgrade cycles. You don't get to choose your upgrades anymore. Broadcom does it for you. And so you have to be ready. If Broadcom comes to them and says, this version of VCF is now obsolete, you have to upgrade. No, you don't get to choose. You can't say, I'm just going to go with it until it's EOL. Broadcom's signaling here that we're going to EOL much more frequently. And so you have to update on a much, much more modern, much more frequent cadence. I think another angle here is IT skills. People who are trained on VMware and aligned with VMware are being disrupted. They don't want to learn VCF. They're quite happy with their, you know, ESX hypervisors and their, you know, isolated vSANs and, you know, some legacy SAN arrays and all that sort of stuff. I think you've just got to get used to the fact that the world is changing now to look like AWS. I think we talked a lot about private cloud over the years and how most enterprise IT is basically not a cloud, a private cloud. But I also think a lot of engineers are complaining heavily about my job is now 50% of my life is spending hours considering different CPU cores on server hardware to try and reduce licensing costs. I'm not actually doing real work anymore. I just spend my life working through licensing waffle.
Right.
I mean, and that's a viable argument. I mean,
it is. It is. Yeah, I mean, I think
spreadsheet engineering isn't, you know.
Yeah, that's not any fun. And I think Broadcom is trying to get all that pain up front. We're making the switch. We're doing it hard and fast. You're on board or you're not. That's up to you. But this is the way we're rolling. So you're in or you're out. And that's definitely a strategy. It's very clear. They've been very clear about it. I think this blog post sort of reemphasizes a lot of that. I think they are trying to gentle some of it with some of the resellers and stuff. They've made a few accommodations for some of those resellers. And on the perpetual license around vSphere, they're saying, you know, they'll announce free access to zero-day security patches for supported versions of vSphere if you don't switch from a perpetual license to the subscription because, you know, they want you to keep using it. So that, I think, is a little sop to perpetual license customers as well. But the end result is this is the plan. This is what we're doing. We've been announcing it and we're still carrying forward. So you're on board or you're not.
Now, I also, you know, you've got to think about a VCF as also big. You're going large here. You're building a private cloud, right?
Yep.
You're not, if you're still thinking of, I took a VM is a copy of what used to be a physical server and I'm running it, you know, and now I'm just running 10 VMs on an x86 server, and that's my cloud. That is not really where it is. It has to be a self-service gateway. It has to be a lot. Now, I believe that Broadcom needs to invest heavily in this product to make it actually work, to fix the things that are wrong, to make it stable and reliable and more flexible. But, you know, Tanzu's in there. It's got the containers. It's got the NSX networking across the whole stack. It's got vSAN. I would think if you are an existing VCF customer that it probably did get cheaper, Drew.
You think so?
So if you're one of the top 2,000 customers that Broadcom took direct, or top 5,000, whatever the number was, you may actually find it cheaper because it was aligned for you, those companies.
Okay.
If you're a smaller company and you're just using a bunch of ESX hypervisors, you know, vSphere Enterprise license, and now you're being forced to go to VCF.
That's where the cost is going to come in.
Well, yeah, it's going to be more expensive because you're going to be displacing your SAN. You've got a whole new networking strategy. You don't need firewalls now, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But it still hurts, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one other thing that this blog post seems to be taking advantage of is that this, we've heard sort of a groundswell of folks realizing public cloud is actually kind of expensive and difficult to operate. So there is talk of either repatriation or at least doing more investment in private cloud, and VMware, I think, is very clearly pushing that message here by saying you can build a private cloud, and we can, if you're on the VMware family, make it very easy for you to move workloads between your VMware private cloud and your VMware friendly public cloud running in AWS. So I think that could potentially be a good message for them to focus on.
Which goes back to what we said before, that Broadcom hasn't done a great job of messaging this type of stuff.
Right. And I think that might be the messaging going forward. We're all about build a nice private cloud, and you can get that hybrid cloud experience if you've got AWS in the public cloud, which a lot of people do, surprisingly. So why not leverage it on both ends?
Yeah. And don't artisanally create one yourself.
Right.
At the end of the day, the vendors can do this better and for a wider range of use cases than you can. The days of you know, handcrafting automation is passing. You're going to build an automation on top of something, I think. I've maintained that for a long period of time.
Yeah.
And it could be hard to let that go if you've had a lot of fun building that. So,
right.
But still, I think that's where we're headed. You're going to be building on top of VCF, not competing with VCF.
Yeah. All right. Link in the show notes if you want to read the blog for yourself. We'll move on. The Chinese government has instructed its country's largest telecom companies to phase out the use of foreign-made, i.e. American, chips by 2027. This is according to Reuters. The move is likely in response to U.S. initiatives to limit the export of high-tech equipment to China. The order could have some significant impact on Intel, AMD, and others. According to Reuters, China accounts for as much as 27% of Intel's revenue.
Yeah, well, not just Intel and AMD, but also Cisco and Juniper and all the other networking companies as well, Nokia and Ericsson.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, spent a lot of time covering Huawei and how the US government worked to kick out Huawei and ZTE from the networks in the West. There was various accusations and so forth made, but the end result is that they've been displaced out of telco networks and that equipment is being replaced. So it was always really just a matter of time, I think, from my point of view, that China was going to say, well, if we're not going to be in your networks, we're not going to put the money in your company's pockets, so we'll move.
Right.
And I suspect they've been waiting for Huawei and ZTE to get their products up to spec, and they've now obviously done that. And, you know, politically it makes sense for the Chinese government to promote its local tech companies. And there are valid concerns, in the same way that, you know, the US government and the UK government, the European government said it's not safe to have these vendors inside of our telco networks. Then I think, you know, in the geopolitics of it, obviously the same needs to be said, that the West needs to be excluded from Chinese networks. And just note, however, that the Chinese Communist Party is not necessarily consistent on these matters. For example, at the moment, they're demanding access to the European market for their electric vehicles, but at the same time, restricting access for imports. They won't let, for example, in Germany, they're demanding access to the German markets, but they won't let Germany export EVs into China. That's just for Chinese vehicles. So there is a little bit of, you know, don't do what I say, don't do as I do as I say, sort of thing going on. So,
of course, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised that China has made this move. It's been flexing its muscle and also trying to push back against U.S. restrictions on importing technology to China. And of course, we did try to, we successfully, I think, got Huawei out of the U.S. and somewhat successfully in with our Western partners. And it's just sort of the same thing the companies do when they, or countries do when they impose tariffs on one another's imports and exports. It's just part of a bigger game.
Yeah.
Although it's got to be bad news for Intel, who is struggling to find out that 27% of your revenue might be going away soon.
But it's also going to affect Apple, Samsung.
Yeah,
because their device, like, you know, Apple's now being told that it's no longer recommended. The Chinese government no longer recommends that people in China buy Apple devices. So that's a gradual sort of put the pressure on moving towards easing Apple out of the country steadily over time. And it's across the board. It's not just here, but in this case, it's just the telco network. So
yeah,
you're not going to see Cisco and Ericsson and Nokia selling their products into Chinese networks going forward.
Yeah. All right, links in the show notes. Just a quick break to tell you about our sponsor today, Palo Alto Networks. Your branch has changed, your SD-WAN should too. Palo Alto Networks wants to show you how AI and ML are powering next-gen SD-WAN and SASE for the branch. SDX Central and Palo Alto Networks hosted an exclusive online event that shows you how next-gen SD-WAN and SASE can help you modernize and secure your branches. Go to sdxcentral.com to get the link to this free event to see the replay, or find the link in the show notes for Network Break episode 475. Back to the news. Consulting giant KPMG released results of a survey of 100 CEOs at large companies in the U.S. A couple of points of interest in this are around the value of AI and its adoption, and somewhat changing attitudes about remote work.
Yeah, we've been a bit of a, you know, talking about distributed work on the show fairly solidly for a few years now, and there was a piece of data in here. So keep in mind that surveying CEOs of top 100 companies, which means somebody inside the company is being surveyed, but it's probably not a CEO again, Drew. They're way too busy to respond to surveys from KPMG, in all honesty. But okay, let's take that at face value. The first one was that CEOs are saying not really having any ethical challenges. They don't care. They're not very worried about security and compliance. They're not very worried about integrating, but they're confident that they've got a good handle on it, Drew.
This was about AI.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
So they totally know what AI is going to do, and they're not worried about any of the negatives that anybody else is talking about.
This jumped out at me. 77% say they are confident that their leadership has a good understanding of Gen AI and how to use it to gain benefits today and in the future. And yes, that number strikes me as wildly overconfident, but maybe that's how you get to be a CEO or another top executive. Yes. It's just your wild overconfidence that you understand this.
Manifesting. It's all going to be good, Drew. It's all going to be good. My people will take care of it.
Just right.
Not even an awareness of the potential negatives is probably the most thing, because that's the other side of it. Not worried about ethical challenges or security and compliance or integration with it. Well, that's fine. It's all we can solve that, Drew.
It'll all work out.
The other part about it that I deeply enjoyed was distributed work. It's fairly clear that CEOs in the US, at least, and I think this is probably patchwork. It's in different countries, it's different, but certainly in the CEOs, there's the hybrid is 46% of them now saying that the pendulum is swinging back to hybrid work. 46% are in favor of hybrid work versus 34% in 2003.
Yeah, 2023.
Before they were talking about, yeah. And before they were saying 62% were demanding in the office 5 days a week. Now it's only 34%.
That's a big drop. So, yeah.
That's a big drop. So congratulations, Drew. You got that when you called it. You got it right on the board. There's a bit more work to go. We've still got 34% of CEOs haven't accepted that not being in the office is normal. And so, but you know, things take time to change, especially executives who are not very good at change at all.
Absolutely. Link in the show notes if you want to see this PDF. We'll move on. United Health Group estimates the cost of a recent cyber attack will cost as much as $1.6 billion. The attack affected a subsidiary of the company and disrupted payments to doctors and healthcare providers for a month. However, the company is still maintaining its financial forecast for 2024 and says that its first quarter revenues actually beat Wall Street estimates. So it took a $1.6 billion hit and you just kind of shrugged it off.
Yeah. There was apparently less claims or something, probably because the systems were down. Even though they put held 800 million over in case of unresolved claims. They actually had a major breach back in February 21. All the systems are offline. Systems were not restored substantially until March 22nd, leaving $14 billion worth of claims backlogged. That means hospitals were unable to claim
to get paid
payment for services rendered. And a lot of hospitals were actually stopping work as a result. So Homeland Security and the White House were involved at some level, so really got high profile. And I did a check today. They actually have a website showing what services are up and what services are down. And in fact, the majority of services are still in a degraded state, Drew. So they're not exactly back. I went over and wandered around the Twitter sphere for various of the security consultants. They're all apparently Alf V or Black Cat received a Bitcoin payment of over $20 million on March 3rd. And I've saw some scuttlebutt saying that the destination of the funds was definitely seen. There was a transfer done. United Health Group refused to comment. United Health Group is the owner of Change Healthcare.
Yeah.
But security researchers have indicated that they believe, or now believe, that the payment gateway actually rug pulled on the hackers, closing it down and then walking off with the $20 million in Bitcoin. So the reason that there's still ongoing problems is because the hackers may have been paid, but they're continuing to demand money because they didn't get the money because the intermediary who was taking the cash and washing it clean took the money.
I think what's happening here is that there were a couple of groups involved in the attack. There are like access brokers who sort of sell you access, and then they're the actual group that pulls off the attack. And one of the groups got the money. One of the hacking groups got the money, and they were supposed to share it with the other hacking group. They did not. A surprise. So I think there's another hacking group out there that is aggrieved because it didn't get paid when this ransom went out. So
yeah, and there's some suggestion that they're still inside the network. Work and they're demanding money because they didn't get any, even though the company paid.
Yes.
Which is, there's a lessons to be learned there for if you ever think about paying the ransom.
Yeah, you might end up paying twice, yes.
Yeah, you might end up. You just never know. And of course, we don't actually know if any of that is true or not because it's all not exactly public information. But just interesting to sort of consider that, you know, major healthcare provider down for a month. Money doesn't seem to have had any impact. I mean, I think people care, but not enough to actually do anything about it. There just seems to be like not a lot about this. And so does cybersecurity matter in 2024, Drew? Not sure.
Yeah, I was thinking about like what kind of remediations should go in place, what kind of incentives or punishments should be levied against executives or something, or against the IT providers of these systems to try to get security under control. I think in this case, if a ransomware attack against a single company can disrupt the entire insurance payment system in the U.S., the remedy here is to just break up that company instead of trying to force more security mandates or whatever. If you're that much of a choke point in the system, I think maybe that's a sign that that system needs to be broken up. Let there be more competition and more resilience rather than having one provider that you can take them out and that disrupts payments for the entire U.S. medical industry. That's an issue. That's not a security issue. That is a monopoly issue.
Well, there is a monopoly issue, but there's also, you know, building these types of IT systems is difficult and building them at scale is theoretically more efficient and cheaper, but it does lead to a, you know, market dominance issue. But I think the challenge here is that this vulnerability was identified and then systems just went out. And in fact, hospitals were disconnecting themselves from this provider to make sure that whatever happened didn't happen to them. Mm-hmm. So imagine if you're working for a regional hospital with very modest IT resources and limited skill sets and so forth, and then all of a sudden you're disconnected, trying to make the case that you need to disconnect your hospital from your key supplier.
Right.
From your money.
Yes,
right?
From your payment provider.
Yes. From your payment, you know, you've got to submit those. That is tough. And who knows? People seem to have muddled through, but I don't think there's any answers here.
Yeah, well, I've got my answer. Break them up. But I'm not sure there's a lot of appetite for that these days.
All right, our last story for the day. Semiconductor manufacturer TSMC announced results for its first fiscal quarter of the year. We'll give the results in U.S. dollars rather than New Taiwan dollars. It had revenues of 18.87 billion U.S., up 16.5% year over year, and net income was up 8.9% versus this time last year. The company expects 2024 to be a good growth year given the ongoing demand for AI processors.
Yeah, TSMC had less total revenue but more profits, apparently because AI chips sell for better prices. My understanding is that they've been sending a lot of the secondary business off to third parties or diverting customers to, they don't want to do the older stuff. They would rather make the new stuff and make good money. It's worth noting that the recent earthquake, which we did cover, resulted in limited damage and only a small amount of disruption. I did some research on that. It turns out that the clean rooms are actually mounted in suspensions. They're actually suspended against vibration inside the building. So the buildings are actually buildings inside buildings. Fascinating stuff. If you go and look it up, you'll come away going boggled about these things. But apparently the damage was limited. There was some actual destruction to various pieces of machinery that weren't actually damped, but not a whole lot. There are signs that investors are nervous about overpriced tech stocks. On the analysis that I'm reading, people are all like, is Apple too expensive? Is it too cheap? Is it going to keep going? Is NVIDIA going to go up? Is the AI boom over? And usually when I see that, it's usually a sign that the market's going to talk itself into a drop at some point. Could be 2 months, could be a week, could be 6 months away. But usually, I don't know if you've noticed this, Drew, but when you track this sort of thing long enough, as soon as they start going, oh, the stock's too high, eventually at some point they convince themselves that the stock's too high.
Of course.
And there'll be a drop that goes around with it.
These are the animal spirits we've heard about in the financial investment sector.
So the TSMC stock did fall something between 3 and 7% in the last 24 hours since the results came out, because people were expecting it to make even more money in the next quarter than it said it would. So the company was expecting 19.6 to 20.4 billion, whereas the consensus was only 19.3 billion, but other people had actually called for more. So I don't know. It's impossible to pick out what people are going on with, but yeah, the stock is down by a bit today.
Yeah. But I think that they're right that 2024 will probably still give them a bit of growth, because I don't know where exactly we are in the AI hype cycle, but I think we are still in it. So everybody's going to squeeze that money out while they can.
$20 billion of capital spend on new equipment.
Yeah.
So they're just going to keep on. One thing about TSMC, they lay out the plans and they run with them. They don't really back off they don't let a quarter's results slow them down. They have a much longer view than the US markets do.
Which makes sense.
They're not living quarter to quarter. They're usually living like 2 to 3 years on a cycle. So they'll just keep pushing on. Yeah.
Yeah, because these manufacturing processes take a long time. So it is a multi-year cycle. All right, that wraps up the news portion. Stay tuned for our sponsored Tech Bytes conversation with Palo Alto Networks, where we talk about SD-WAN and SASE. It's coming right up. Secure Access Service Edge, or SASE, combines SD-WAN with cloud-delivered security services, including Next-Gen Firewall, CASB, Secure Web Gateway, and others. And you can mix and match your SD-WAN and cloud security to get one from vendor A and one from vendor B. And that kind of approach across the IT stack is common because, for example, it lets you find a balance between price, features, and performance, or it can make for more competitive bids for your business and doesn't necessarily lock you into a single vendor. But today on the Tech Bytes, sponsor Palo Alto Networks is here to offer a counter-argument. When it comes to SASE, a single vendor approach may have benefits that beat the mix and match option. Rajesh Khari, Senior Product Marketing Manager at Palo Alto Networks, is my guest to make this argument. So Rajesh, welcome back to Packet Pushers. So I just described some of the advantages of a mix and match strategy for SASE. What are the challenges of that mix and match approach?
Well, Drew, traditionally, companies have relied on this mix and match approach, you know, with point products from multiple vendors. As you mentioned, it has worked so far, but with a lot of challenges, right? The first and foremost challenges for the infrastructure team or the NOC and the SOC teams are the multiple consoles that they have to leverage for managing the local network access from the branches or security in the cloud, including the visibility end to end. Second most challenging thing for them is the limited or no security inspection at the branch for the local segments, for the IoTs, or any particular network segments that need to be really inspected and verified. If you look at the other major challenge is just the maintenance and the support this mix and match approach requires, right? It can be time consuming. It can break current deployments while you're trying to upgrade or manage multiple solutions. And just the incompatibility between these can create a whole new set of outages because of this approach.
Okay, so things like, you know, you said I've got to manage a bunch of different devices at the branch and in the cloud, and that's lots of consoles, lots of context switching, lots of different systems I have to go into to find out what's happening or set policy or get information, and also just maintaining a whole bunch of different things that can cause other operational issues, outages, and so on. If I've got to do a bunch of different patching over here and upgrades over here and so on, that can basically affect my ability to provide this service.
Correct. So oftentimes when I talk to customers, the hash one concern for them is, on a given day, if I have an issue, I need to talk to five different vendors, support teams with those five different vendors. It falls into my charter to correlate all these issues and then identify the root cause. That's painful, time consuming, and literally takes a lot of cycles from my team. That's exactly what any infrastructure manager we talk to agrees upon. And then they're like, that doesn't give us enough time or the required time to work on future innovations, doing the required upgrades, bringing in newer technologies, and improving user experience. So everything is being halted because of these day-to-day operation complexity.
Okay, so those are sort of the arguments against mix and match. Are there pro arguments for a unified approach to SASE?
There's no wonder that, you know, unified SASE is becoming the centerpiece of any conversation within an infrastructure team or even in organizations with a NOC and the SOC team. Businesses want to bring together these separate teams to work, to improve productivity, to reduce the trouble tickets, and also increase their uptime. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, ensure that the security is ensured, the better security outcomes are always there, considering how much the threat landscape has evolved. So when I look at the significant benefits of a unified SASE, the first and the foremost is better security outcomes, whether it is for your users, applications, and devices. That includes even the IoT. The second one is exceptional network performance, or I would say application performance as well. Only with a unified solution, you can manage performance end-to-end. In a mix-and-match approach, the lack of visibility and the different point products really limit that kind of performance guarantee. But in a unified solution, you can ensure that, yes, all the way from the user to the application and everything in between runs flawlessly. And last but not the least, as I mentioned, the automation or simplification of IT operations. You need all this data, whether it is from your user, applications, network, security, in a single data lake. Only then you can leverage the power of AI to automate a lot of these day two ops. Mm-hmm. So only a unified solution can deliver this kind of three key benefits that I just pointed out.
Yeah. Okay. So let's dig into them a little bit. And maybe since we just touched on, this AI or this data issue, let's start there. So I think what you're saying is, if I've got a unified SASE, that means in one data lake, I'm able to get network data, application performance data, security information, and all of that is being used by, you know, it's being essentially by my vendor, formatted the same way, analyzed the same way. That uniformity really maybe helps deliver more insights and information that I can take action on or that can be automated, as opposed to having some SD-WAN data siloed over here and my cloud security data silo over there.
Exactly. So with a unified data lake, you know, you get a complete view of the data, whether it is across security, networking, or operations in one central place. That single management allows you to have consistent formatting, structure, and labeling for all your data. Uh-huh. That is really important when you're using AI/ML to analyze these data, gain deep insights, and then proactively provide you analytics on what is a trend, whether it is bandwidth consumption over a period of time, whether it is a certain exposure to a given threat or a certain application introducing certain threats. All these requires this unified data lake to provide the end user visibility early on so that they can act on it. They can also resolve it before a significant outage or a data breach.
Do you feel like when you're talking to customers that this sort of data uniformity argument carries more weight these days, given the considerable interest there is around machine learning and AI?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So as I mentioned, you know, that automated detection of network incidents, that proactive and predictive analytics is so important to infrastructure managers. Oftentimes in the past, these leaders were in a very reactive mode. They have an outage, things get escalated, there's a loss in business and productivity, and they are scrambling for information. Mm-hmm. Imagine the same kind of information is available to them a couple of weeks back or a month earlier, saying that, I'll give a quick example. This particular WAN interface connecting to these branches or across all the branches is constantly experiencing bandwidth limits, or it's always functioning at a degraded manner. With that visibility, they have two choices. Before even the end user experience is impacted, they can either add more bandwidth or they can change their business policies to take other available band lengths, or they can talk to their providers and resolve the issue.
Right.
So it gives them all the options ahead of time, so they are not in a reactive mode, in a very, very proactive mode. And that can be done only with that unified data lake and the analysis that is being done with the power of AI.
So one of the other things you mentioned was the unified approach gets you better security outcomes for users, for applications, and for IoT devices because you've got unified security controls at the branch and in the cloud. Can you drill into that a little bit more? Is it because I've got, you know, sort of a unified console where I can have network and security folks working from the same set of information? Is it something else?
So having a unified solution ensures that the security enforcement takes place in the cloud or in the branch. It can suit any number of use cases based on the user and the application. For example, right, securing east-west traffic, URL filtering for select traffic at the branches, or having a full inspection at the branch for latency-sensitive apps, all can be achieved with a unified solution, right? The same security policies can be inherited with the help of our app IDs, user IDs, and device ID. Remember, the users are sitting either in the branch or in the remote. So they are accessing a certain application, exiting out of a certain device, or going through a certain branch network. So it becomes imperative that the understanding of who the user is, what their access are, how they are trying to access these applications so that the right security enforcement can take place, the right remediations in terms of SD-WAN can be implemented. And also, every single traffic can be inspected by the most comprehensive security solution like Prisma Access, where globally and massively distributed POPs which support all advanced security capabilities to ensure that you have the zero trust. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the biggest advantage of having the unified SASE solution. And you also brought up a great point about devices or IoT, right? Let's talk about how typically this is being done in today's world. You have a branch network, you have a bunch of IoT devices. The ID administrators typically use a sensor to identify what devices are there, who's the vendor it's from, what operating system they are using. And then they send all this information to data centers because that's where they have some kind of an IoT inventory. They can match up and send security enforcement policies. It could be segmentation or granular security policies by itself. But with Prisma SD-WAN, you have this ION appliance sitting at every branch. We allow 100% visibility of all IoT devices, regardless of the manufacturer, regardless of the operating system. So now you can get rid of the IoT sensors, but that's not it. You can actually send this IoT application access directly to the cloud. Why? Because you're protected from the Prisma Access POPs. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, Prisma Access POPs all have the IoT inventory, which is constantly updated based on machine learning. So now, even if you have the latest devices or an unknown vendor or an unknown operating system, we have that database to actually match and make sure that you get visibility into what the device is. Based on the device, based on the vulnerabilities that it potentially could carry, the security policies will be enforced. So you have that superior security for all IoT devices while you're getting rid of point products, while you're securing the applications, even in the cloud. So that's like a leap from where we are or where we were for IoT protection.
The third thing you mentioned was performance. And I wanted to drill down on that a little bit because I understand the notion that there are benefits to unifying, you know, my SD-WAN, that the network connectivity and getting the cloud delivered security services, but an SD-WAN should deliver good performance to that cloud POP, whether it's the same POP from the vendor or a different vendor, shouldn't it? Or is there something I'm missing there?
Well, you're right. So the SD-WAN came into existence to overcome these challenges you just pointed out, right? I want to utilize more than one WAN connections. I want to have more bandwidth availability. I need to remediate issues like performance degradation, network SLAs, and outages at all times. Yes, that is still the case. But let's also remember, most of the current SD-WAN solution, they just look at the network. They understand the network. If the underlying network has some issues, it tries to remediate it. It used to work in a very bookended solution. Like if you're connecting the branches to the data center, you have a very reliable way of measuring these SLAs. And based on it, you can control the traffic engineering. But that has changed. Applications have moved to the cloud. It's SaaS. So organizations are increasingly accessing these applications directly. They are not sending it to their data center.
Right.
So using the same network SLAs that you measured with a bookended model now cannot work for these open-ended applications because they're just not relevant. And when you are doing such remediation, then it's a very reactive mode, or it's just throwing a dart in the dark, right? And hoping that it sticks or it works. So our Prisma SD-WAN, which is a next-generation SD-WAN solution, works at a layer 7. We took a completely different approach. We went from a top to bottom architecture, where we look at all application flows, identify the application SLAs, whether it is data center apps or cloud or SaaS apps, and based on the performance SLAs, and of course, we also add in network SLAs, as the qualifiers, to do the remediation, right? So our customers get the best of traffic engineering with our SD-WAN solution. Now, you also, as I mentioned, the threat landscape is increasing. People want to inspect and verify each user traffic, even from a trusted device or a user or a branch,
course,
right?
Yeah.
That is
yep.
the whole thought process and the whole evolution of zero trust. To do that, you need to have this massively distributed cloud-delivered security, which Prisma Access provides. Now, why does this exceptional performance, it can be delivered only by unified SASE? That's because Prisma SD-WAN natively integrates to Prisma Access. When I say natively, when someone brings up Prisma SD-WAN on their branch, it immediately identifies what is the closest available Prisma Access POPs. And it connects to the low latency, close proximity Prisma Access presence. And it also does in a very redundant fashion. So even, so it's like extending the SD-WAN all the way to the security presence, right? And now, because of that, the performance is ensured end to end. So the SLAs are extended not just at your branch, but all the way to your security POPs, all the way to the application.
So you're saying I can get an extended SLA from the SD-WAN gateway through the cloud security POP to my destination because it's a unified solution, as opposed to if I was using an SD-WAN from vendor A and and cloud security from vendor B, I may be dealing with two different SLAs and trying to figure out where performance hangups are happening could be harder to do or even harder to meet those SLAs.
Exactly. So that's what the benefit our customers get with a unified SASE solution. So even in our dashboard, if you look at our visibility or the observability, you can pinpoint from a user to the application and everything in between. That is your branch egress to your carriers, to your Prisma Access POPs, all the way to the applications, right? That's right. All the path that a given application traffic is traversing. So they can identify where the performance has been impacted at every single hop. That's very powerful. Yes. As an IT administrator, if I know the issue lies with a carrier connectivity, I can immediately raise a ticket and get that resolved. Boom, my user experience is ensured. Most of the time, the user doesn't even know that their performance was degraded or will be degraded in a course of time, right? So that's exactly the value prop we provide with the unified SASE solution.
Okay. Well, Rajesh, I think you definitely gave folks something to think about, this notion of unified SASE, weighing the pros and cons versus mix and match. If folks want to get more information from Palo Alto Networks to continue investigating, where should they go?
Just go to paloaltonetworks.com/SASE/SD-WAN. They can find all the information that we just shared, and they can learn much more. They can even talk to one of our sales folks to take the next steps.
All right. That's paloaltonetworks.com/SASE. That's SASE/SD-WAN. Thanks, Rajesh, for joining us. And thanks to Palo Alto Networks for being a sponsor. And thanks to you for listening. If you like this, there are many more fine, free technical podcasts and our community blog. It's all at packetpushers.net. You can join our Slack community at packetpushers.com/community. You can also follow us on LinkedIn, hear us on Spotify, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.